Kathy Gowdy, alternate defense counsel for Adam Brannon, the appellant. In going through...
Ms. Gowdy, you can lower that if you'd like. On the right-hand side, there's a toggle switch that will make the whole podium move down.
It never goes far enough. There will be an ADA complaint at some time. In going through the briefs of the people during mine, I was struck by how we each took the opposite position on things. In the argument about the evidence and the abrogation of the right to present a defense, the people are arguing that there need to be more specificity. In going through the arguments about the pen packs and on the habitual, the people are saying assumptions are okay. The judge could look at this and make assumptions. And I'm thinking how ironic. I was on the exact opposite side. But I think the way you need to look at this is that the right to present a defense is constitutional. And yes, he made an adequate thing. And yes, you don't need to be contract writing when you're in a trial to report these kind of objections. He objected on confrontation. He objected on hearsay. He objected correctly. When we're talking about a habitual offense, it's established that there is a very high burden, a statutory burden on the prosecutor, and there should not be assumptions. It is the right of the defendant to have a defense. There is no constitutional right to the people. So with that said, as far as the habituals goes, what we are requesting is that you find that the habitual was not adequately proven and that the case be remanded for sentencing without the habitual enhancement. There are several reasons for that. One was the amendment orally done after evidence had closed on one of the counts. This was an amendment, a substance, not a form. The analysis of Ybarra, which requires prejudice in a form objection, does not apply to this. This was substance that goes back to the beginnings of Colorado law. The who, what, where, and how need to be put into the actual count so that the defendant can properly make a defense, so the defendant can pull the right cases to investigate, so the defendant can do everything you need to do to defend against that count. And was that a constitutionally found conviction?
May I ask you a question, Ms. Gowdy?
Yes.
I understand the argument you're making, and let's say, for purposes of my question, that you're right, that this was substantive. They pled they were going to prove theft, and they made a mistake and it was forgery. Let's assume that. It's true, is it not, that you had discovery, or not you, your client got discovery in this case showing what the case was and that he had pled guilty to the forgery, not the theft. Is that true?
It's not on the record. Discovery is not brought up as part of the record, so it isn't part of the facts that are before me.
Let me ask you then, just as a hypothetical, because I frankly don't remember if it's in the record or not. But if your client had discovery, say they got the entire pen pack from that case, all the discovery, the plea agreement, all of that, would your client be prejudiced, or is that even an issue, assuming those facts?
It client would be prejudiced because that is the only sort of defense you can do as a defense attorney and an habitual. You take the information, you lay every aspect against it, against your discovery, and you say, aha, they're not going to be able to prove that one. You don't go out and find the correct one. You know, that's what that high burden means in a habitual. In fact, I won once because they forgot to prove it was a felony. But
that's what they have to show, right?
Right.
So what difference does it make what type of a felony?
It goes back to the who, what, where that needs to be informed. Forgery is not the same crime as theft.
But it is a felony, which counts towards one of the crimes for which a person can be found a habitual criminal, correct?
It is.
And once you have the judgment that says it's a forgery or theft, whatever, that proves the element of that habitual crime, doesn't it?
It would if they'd have charged it. They don't have that crime charged.
But let me see if I understand you, Ms. Gowdy. I think, and correct me, but I think what you're saying is they charged that they were going to prove in count 11 that your guy had a conviction for theft. And I think what you're saying is the defendant has every right to sit back and do nothing and show up and say, dismiss that charge because he wasn't. It's similar to when you get a traffic ticket and the police officer makes a mistake on the ticket and you show up and the the municipal judge dismisses it because there was a defect on it. Is that what you, I'm just not trying to put words in your mouth, I'm trying to understand what you said just a minute ago.
Well, it's a little more serious than a traffic ticket, but yes, it is. It is a constitutional right of the defendant to do nothing. The burden is entirely on the prosecution.
But your point is you have the right to, they said theft, even though they only had to prove a felony. The fact that they said theft in their information or amendment to the information, I think your point is the defendant could rely on that, and they can't show up and change their mind at the last minute.
In fact, they can't change their mind after they put in all the evidence, in fact, when they're doing their closing argument. That is exactly my point. And it's the basic principles of fundamental fairness, because the information says who, Adam Brannon, what, committed forgery, or was it theft? And that is incorrect. It is a matter of form. It is not a matter of form. It is totally substance, because they're different statutes.
When did they move to amend the information in this case to change the reading from theft to forgery, correct?
The prosecutor orally moved after both sides had rested in closing argument. So it was after the time that they can amend as a matter of right, even though they had the discovery, if they had it.
I'm sorry. The what is not theft or forgery, the what is felony. This is not a substantive crime. This is part of the habitual proceedings.
But theft could also be a misdemeanor. You have to go into the actual statute. You have to take a look at what they were charged with in a habitual and see if it was a felony at the time he was convicted. And all of those are the elements that need to be proven. You can't prove an element of theft if the information says forgery. You're not on notice. And there's no obligation on the defendant to go through every crime in the statute book and say maybe there was an element here or there. It's up to the people to prove it. It's up to the people to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. They failed to do this, and the amendment was incorrect.
Did your client make a record of the prejudice argument that you're making now? I think we all understand. Did your client make this argument below?
The client objected to the amendment. He objected that it was substance and not form. When questioned under the reasoning of Yavar as to prejudice, he said, "I stand on my objection." That is the limit of the objection made below.
Okay.
Secondly, in the habitual phase, the pen pads that were used violated his right to confront witnesses by not being presented in the correct manner. The statute of 18.1.3 is constitutional if it's read to either have duly authenticated conviction orders. Those are the actual conviction orders from the court. You don't need a witness. But the evidence from the DOC, the photos, the fingerprints, all that is on the top is a certificate of DOC that these are documents we have in a file somewhere. They're not kept together as pen pals. They are requested, and that was in the record specifically. The paralegal testified, "I was told to assemble a pen pack." I believe it's a 1045. I was asked to assemble certified records. So this is a request by the prosecution to their paralegal to assemble records that are held in various places in DOC and stick them together as a pen pack, certified as one.
So you said held in DOC. The Moore case, the people cited in supplemental authority, doesn't that address all of this?
It does, but that was a plain error analysis for one thing, which is a much higher burden. This was properly objected to.
Under plain error, they said that pen packs are DOC records.
They are, and I don't know if there's a factual basis to make that assumption. It's not in the record in this case that they're DOC. In this case, the paralegal said, "I contacted and I gathered and I assembled the records. I have to deal with the facts that are before me in this case and not engage in assumptions," which is the problem. So what we have then is clearly testimonial. They could have proven that if they'd have had, under 902, the self-authenticating copies of the convictions. Those are by the statute and by the rules of evidence if they'd had each conviction certified. What they didn't have was a complete pen pack for each one. And this pen pack phrase is just an administrative phrase, which makes it even more offensive on the constitutional aspect. And what they didn't even have was complete ones for each crime. Some had photos, some had minimuses, some had all of it, some had fingerprints, some did not. They said it was just totally incomplete. It violated his right to confront. For example, on the fingerprints, the testimony was hearsay that they sent it to the public, to the police department, and the police department said, yeah, these are the same fingerprints. Well, that clearly hearsay. And they needed the person there to say, how do you know? How do you know? Where are you looking at the whirls and the swirls and the various things you do in cross-examination for a fingerprints for anything? So the pen pats themselves, as offered in this case, violated his right to confrontation. They were incomplete documents, and each documents were inside were not certified. The convictions weren't certified. They were simply, there was a certification of the DOC secretary saying, hey, these are what we have in our file. That does not rise to the level required under Melendez-Diaz in the Inez case. And I do need
that's
to
not, I'm sorry, but let me interject, because that, I thought, is what Moore held, that these are records from DOC. And if it's a DOC secretary that gathered these, that sounds like a, on all fours with the Moore case.
It's not clear. The paralegal said she contacted DOC to assemble a pen pack, and then she got the documents and put the pen pack together. That's the facts we have here. And I do need to apologize on the Moore case. I filed a supplement objecting that wasn't published. I misread. I recently started on Westlaw, and it said not published. And so I went back and checked. It is published, and I apologize for that.
Thank you.
On that. But it isn't exactly the same thing as the Moore. For one thing, they didn't have a factual basis in Moore to know where these documents came from. And I think that's where all of this confrontation comes from. Where do these documents come from? What authenticity do we have that was put in this assemblage? I mean, they could be...
But the documents were authenticated. I mean, you just have a custodian record say they are what they are.
The PEMPAC was authenticated.
Right.
Not each document, the convictions, the photographs, the fingerprints, they were not, and they could have been easily. Or have someone testify as to what they have so that they can be questioned. Either do it under 902 and do it correctly, or have somebody there that you can question about. This doesn't really look like him. You know, it was one of the facts in this case, white Hispanic. That could be one of the issues. And they were incomplete.
One thing I guess I'm not following, Ms. Gowdy, is why you think this is testimonial under Melendez-Diaz. I mean, in that case, the court, I think the Supreme Court said, and I know the Moore case said as well, they were the certificates there were the functional equivalent of an affidavit, that they were prepared for testimony in that very case. Here, the testimony you've cited to us of the paralegal work, I'm pulling these together from DOC. So we clearly know they weren't prepared for this case. They were already prepared. She pulled together the packages, that's fine. But is there any, I guess I'm not understanding why you think these are testimonial here.
The packet itself is testimonial nature, clearly, because it's prepared for this hearing.
That's my point. No, I'm not sure that it is. The documents existed before.
But they don't exist as a pen pack. They're certifying a pen pack and saying, this is it. They don't sit in the DOC in a file in order like that. The DA paralegal tells them what to send. So it's clearly testimonial because they're not requesting it except for to prosecute.
Where's the right of confrontation violated? How did she get the doc? I mean, if the documents are what they purport to be, what is the difference whether she took them from file A or file B or file C? The only issue is, are they what they purport to be? Evidence of a conviction. Isn't that the only issue here?
Those would be the conviction documents, but they also include fingerprints and photographs that could be challenged. Where did they come from? Those are the things that you would ask about, and those that you don't have because they just stick them in like a sandwich in between the certified convictions, even when they don't even have minimuses or convictions in the pen pads, which they did not.
But there's identifying marks with the fingerprints that these are the fingerprints of so-and-so, correct? All right. So what is she going to be cross-examined on? Where did she find this fingerprint card that says defendant Brandon's name is associated with these fingerprints? I guess I don't understand where the denial of confrontation comes from.
The fingerprints would come because you would go into the science of fingerprints. You could bring in your own expert. You could take a look at it. The photographs would come. When was this taken? Was this for a case that he was actually convicted in, particularly in a case like this where there weren't photos with every pen pack?
Why couldn't those questions be asked in this case? I don't understand.
Because the paralegal wouldn't know, because there aren't her records. The person that you'd have to ask these of wasn't there in the courtroom to cross-examine. The person who assembled it wasn't there. There was, they're not business records because they aren't kept in the course of business in that frame, in that format.
Assembled together. You're so serious in the assembly of these documents is what creates a problem.
Part of, the assembly is makes a testimonial, but the documents each and says, I think it brings in documents that could be confronted and gives them the glamour of being authenticated through the rev, through the PEMPAC certification. And it's not certifying the authenticity of those documents. It's certifying the authenticity that we have these in our file. We're not going into what those documents represent. And when we're talking about enhancing a sentence by four times, it's serious.
Scotty, I see you're out of time. Gosh.
Thank you.
You can raise that if you'd like to.
No, actually, I would concur with counsel. It never goes low, I just put higher heels. That was my only recourse, and maybe I should follow. Maybe I should follow. The bad arches later in life. Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer L. Ward, number 38342. I represent the people of the state of Colorado in this action. I'm going to start right on the PEMPAC issue because that's where things had just wrapped up with my opposing counsel. So I'll start there and then I'll move backwards to the substantive, the amendment of the count, if that's all right with the court. Of course, if the court has any questions, just jump in. I filed a supplemental authority back in January citing the Moore case, and I'm not going to belabor it. I really do think the Moore case is on point on this issue. I agree with the reasoning of Judge Webb. The court gave two reasons why this didn't violate confrontation. They approached it and first said that these were not created for the purpose of prosecution. And then that's star page 6. And then if you go to the next page, there's a second reason where they discuss the assembly of records. And that also didn't violate the confrontation clause. And I would ask this court to adopt Moore's reasoning, well, Judge Webb's reasoning and the rest of his division, because I think it was sound. I really do. So, in my brief, I laid out how all the different PEMPACs related to the convictions with the DOC number.
Let me ask a question. Ms. Galley suggests that the fact that it was a plain error review may make a difference. Does that make any difference here?
I don't agree. No, sir.
Is there some issue whether the evidence, the record here is not as well developed in the Moore case? I haven't really read the record in the Moore case, so I don't really know.
No, sir. I don't believe the record was any more developed than it was here. In fact, during the proceedings when the objection was made, it's to me and my reading, of course, I'm coming from a certain perspective when I read the record. When I read the record, it appears to me that defense counsel had the discovery, that he had reviewed the discovery. If there's an allegation he didn't review the discovery, that's a completely different claim. But it appeared that he read the discovery, he reviewed all the pen packs, and he said, I stand on my objection. And he didn't, I mean, and counsel, the prosecution went through point by point and said, this is how he got them, brought in witnesses, had testimony, this is how he got them, DOC secretary. I mean, he went through. And there was someone there, and I apologize, I can't remember whether it was an investigator or a technician. I really don't remember the record on that point. There was someone there who did talk about examining the fingerprint cards back to back.
But these are all DOC records.
Yes, I believe they were all DOC records, as I recall. Did I answer your question earlier? Okay. So as I laid out in my brief, these records link defendant from one crime to another to another to another by DOC number, by the last four of his social, by his physical description, by the fingerprint cards, and by his date of birth. So I think it was very clear that this was the Adam Brannon that did these prior felonies, and that he was properly convicted of these habitual counts. Moving to the amendment of the count, the amendment did happen during the habitual phase. And what
at the close of the evidence or while the evidence was still open? She said it was after the evidence was closed and it was too late to amend.
You know, I don't...
Does it make a difference on it?
I don't think it makes a difference, and I'll tell you why, but I honestly don't recall that part. It may have, but I'm not completely clear on it. It's been some time. I reviewed the record in preparation, obviously, but if you have seen the record, it's 1,000 pages of PDF. It doesn't make a difference in the end, because his counsel was on notice that it was a felony. And they did have the documents that said it was forgery. And counsel knew that. And in fact, counsel at the proceeding never says, I couldn't defend against this. I was caught. And counsel never says, oh, I'm sandbagged. I had no idea. And counsel didn't ask for a continuance either. Counsel just went ahead. Counsel knew what the underlying felony was.
Isn't it a little troubling? I shouldn't ask a rhetorical question. I'm a little troubled, and I would like to hear your response. Whenever we draft an opinion, we're going to adopt a rule. And I'm concerned about the rule you're asking us to adopt here. I mean, the indictment says that he was convicted of a felony, namely theft. And I will tell you very candidly, Ms. Ward, that Ms. Cowdy's argument has some force with me. And again, I recognize we're talking about much more serious than a traffic offense, and I didn't mean to be flip when I raised that. But here, the defendant seems to me to have every right to be waiting for you and lay in wait for the prosecution to prove what they said they were going to prove, theft. You didn't have to say that. You could have just said a felony in case whatever. You said theft. And it seems to me the defendant can lay in wait and then dismiss. There's no proof I was convicted of the crime they charged. Where does the rule go? If you charge someone with felony murder and you say the felony was robbery, can you just come in later and say, gee, we made a mistake, it was burglary or some other felony? That's really troubling. And so I'd appreciate your addressing that. I hear your argument. You know, maybe the defendant didn't say it. I asked Ms. Gowdy the question. I'm prejudiced. I was sandbagging. Maybe he should have. Put that aside. Where's the line? I mean, how do we not find prejudice when you pled one thing and after the evidence is over, you say, oops, we made a mistake. It was something else. Why isn't that prejudice?
Well, I agree, Your Honor, that it could have been done better, right? I mean, I think we're all clear it could have been done better. And I understand your argument. But what I see here is, it's hard to put in words and frame it in a very clear, bright line rule. Because, as we've always said, trials are never perfect. And you're not entitled to a perfect trial. You are entitled to a fair proceeding. That is what you are entitled to. I don't like seeing mistakes in things. And, you know, look what I do for a living. You know, this is what I do. But, so I would say that the rule really should be, was it a fair proceeding? Just like we do with other things. Was it a fair proceeding? It was a fair proceeding. He had the information. I know you want me to leave the sandbagging to the side for a moment. But it's gone down to, is it a fair proceeding? Yes, it was. He had the information.
The record information.
He had the information that he was being charged with a particular count for a felony. That's what he had the information for. Now, he also had in that information that it was forgery.
Can I ask you, sir, I just want to make sure I'm understanding. I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're talking about discovery now, that there were discovery materials he had, or are you saying just...
The discovery materials. I haven't moved on to the actual...
Yeah, it's not just the information amendment. Yes. You're saying there were discovery... Okay.
There was discovery information, and the habitual counts had been talked about throughout the trial, if I recall correctly. That there were going to be these different habituals and things of that nature.
And what in the record shows us that the defendant had this discovery, these discovery materials?
The first thing in the record that speaks to that is defense counsel never says, I didn't get any discovery. I mean, that's number one. Number two, I think there was testimony that it was all sent over, and I don't know if that was the secretary or if it was the district attorney, but there was testimony it was all sent over and it was in the possession of defense counsel. So I don't know that I answered your question to the degree you'd like me to, but I think the bottom line is it's not a perfect proceeding, it's a fair proceeding, and he had a fair proceeding. And he knew this charge was coming. There was no argument that he was unable to defend against it. And if he really truly, if there was an issue where he felt that he was unable to defend against it, he should have asked for, at the minimum, a continuance. But he didn't. Now, this maybe is all... information that will come up again in 3 years' time in a different proceeding, but for this proceeding here today on direct appeal, this was a valid proceeding.
I appreciate your candor, Ms. Ward. Can I ask you just one more question on this, and I'll leave you be? And I didn't go back and look at all of the minimus and add everything up. Does this habitual count make a difference in the sentence he got in the real world?
I just checked that, actually, before coming over. And I believe that there were four habitual counts that he was convicted of, and that would put him under the big habitual statute, which is a four times the maximum. If you lost this one habitual count, I believe that drops him down to three, which would put him... Yes, sorry. I believe it drops him down, but you know what? I may be wrong on that, Your
Honor. I actually thought there were five, and this
yes.
would drop him down
yes,
to four,
you know,
and it would make no difference whatsoever.
Yeah, I was actually scribbling my notes, and I've misconstrued my four for being four habituals. It's actually four times the maximum. So, no, Judge Richmond is right. There were actually more. Dropping this count will make no difference to his sentencing. My apologies. I shouldn't scribble.
You should see mine. No problem.
I really didn't have any other comments for the court today, unless the court has questions on the remaining few issues. Then, with that, I'll just ask you to affirm his judgment and conviction as well as his sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.